Good evening. When I was a little fella, before our family moved to Tennessee, I grew up in East Tennessee, but I was actually born in San Diego, California. My father worked as a welder in the shipyard there. And shortly before we made the move to Tennessee, in fact, we did because the shipyard where he was working shut down, but when that shutdown took place, Dad had been out of work for a little while. And things were difficult, and my folks were trying to figure out how to make things work and what we were going to do next. And, of course, my little sister and I was six, she was five at the time, and we had no idea, you know, what kind of stresses my parents had. But they decided we were going to splurge one night, and we were going to go get us a Shakey's pizza. And so we got into the panel truck that my dad drove and had a bench seat on the front. And so Dad was driving and Mom was on the passenger side. And my sister and I were on the bench seat between them. And we went and got us a Shakey's pizza. And we were on our way home. And it was a warm, you know, afternoon, evening. And the windows were all rolled down. And there wasn't any AC in it, so they had to be. But we were singing a little jingle that they used to sing at the drive-in movie theater whenever they advertised the concessions. I don't remember how the jingle went, but we were singing it together in the car. And Dad made the turn into our home on Sunshine Street, and Mom was holding the pizza box, and he turned in a little quick, and when he did, the pizza box went out the window. And it landed in the drive, box lid topside down and the box lid open. And so it was full of gravel and grass and dirt and all kinds of stuff. And so we picked it up and we went inside and we ate it anyway. That is a favorite story of my family. And part of what makes it special and fun for our family is because it represented a time when we were all together. And I mean, Dad was where he needed to be, where he was supposed to be, behind the wheel, driving, you know, and Mom was there beside him, and my sister and I, things were well, and times were hard for them, but we had no idea because of the security that we found there in their company. And I think about times when God's people come together like this, and I must say to you that I feel that way when I'm among you. And I just marvel at and am grateful for the wisdom of God that he saw fit to give us a family in which we know unconditional love, in which we find acceptance despite our warts, where we are loved, where we are encouraged, where we have someone to help when we're down, someone to rejoice and celebrate with us when we have reasons to rejoice. And so I'm thankful anew to be together with you tonight and for what God has done, the great Redeemer, to save us and to make us a part of his wonderful family. Thank you. I want to invite you to turn to Mark, the fifth chapter, if you will, tonight. Mark chapter 5. We're going to read together the 20 verses from that context. Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 20. This is a favorite story of mine, and it's a favorite story of mine because I identify with it. You might be surprised at that when you see the story that we're going to read, but I really do identify with this story, and I hope that you'll find some truths in it that resonate with you as well. Mark 5, beginning in verse 1, speaking of Jesus and his disciples, the text says, "And they came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes, and when Jesus had come out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him, and he had his dwelling among the tombs. And no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. And constantly, night and day, among the tombs and in the mountains, he was crying out and gashing himself with stones. And seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, What do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you, by God, do not torment me. For he had been saying to him, come out of the man, you unclean spirit. And Jesus was asking him, what is your name? And he said to him, my name is Legion, for we are many. And he began to entreat Jesus earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now there was a big herd of swine feeding there on the mountain. And the demons entreated him, saying, send us into the swine so that we may enter them. And Jesus gave them permission. And coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them, and they were drowned in the sea. And the herdsmen ran away and reported it in the city and out in the country, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed sitting down, clothed, and in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion. And they became frightened. And those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the swine. And they began to entreat Jesus to depart from their region. And as Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was entreating him that he might accompany him. But Jesus did not let him, but said to him, go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim at Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. Question. Have you ever seen anything like this happen? I'm going to say something to you that might sound a little bit surprising. I see things like this happen all the time. I'll explain what I mean by that. But one of the things I love about this context is that I think that part of the purpose for of this context is to unmask for us what it is that's really going on in the world. And I mean what is really, really going on in the world every day. Just a couple months ago, we went in to see Dr. Pittner. She's our dentist. And one of the things that the hygienist always does when we go in to see Dr. Pittner is she takes a little scrape off of, you know, up near the gum line, and she puts it on a slide. And they have this microscope they put it under that's really cool because they can turn on a TV monitor in the room, and when they do, it shows you what's in the slide, the little sample that she took. And so the hygienist had taken one of the slides and had taken a little scrape, and she put it on the microscope and turned on the TV. And when she did, I mean, the thing came alive. Now, it was just a little bit, you know, it was a little bit of saliva, just a tiny, tiny little bit. But it was, I mean, there was a whole sea that I could see on the screen there. And there were all kinds of things moving. I mean, not just like tens of things. I mean like hundreds of things, maybe thousands of things. And there were little things that were spinning around, and there were little things that were like that looked like shoes that were darting across. And there were these corkscrew things that came swimming along, and she said, oh, that's bad. I mean, and it made you want to go home and floss. I mean, like right away. What's so cool about that, what she does with the slide and what she does with the screen, is it shows you a world that you otherwise couldn't see. With that amazing technology, she was able to show like what was going on in that little spot next to one tooth in my mouth. And what that gave some insight into is to like the whole world of what was going on in my mouth and what sort of things I needed to do in order to take better care of my teeth. Well, this passage, I think, and so many passages like it, but this passage that we're going to look at tonight gives us that kind of insight into what it is that's going on into our world. It's like the Lord took one slice out of his ministry and put it under the microscope and expose for us what's going on behind the scenes. Things that might not be evident to us on the surface about what's going on in our world, but things that are going on in our world all the time. The first thing that I want to suggest to you that this text unmasks for us is that it unmasks for us the real ugliness of sin. It unmasks for us the real ugliness of sin. There's a lot about demon possession that I don't understand. A lot of questions I have that I'd like to know about, like how did a person get demon possessed? Like, was it totally against their will, or was there some way in which they became vulnerable to that because of their behavior? I don't know. But I do see some sense in the fact that if God was going to come into the world, and if divinity was going to be incarnate, that perhaps there was some wisdom or some necessity in the purpose of God that evil too be incarnate, so that there could be a bit of a showdown between the God-man and Satan and him unleashing all of his power to show the might of the kingdom of God and the ultimate victory, the ultimate and final victory that there will be of God's kingdom over the kingdom of Satan. I don't know if that's the case or not, if that's how we're to understand that, but I've pondered or wondered about whether or not that's the case. But I do think this about demon possession in particular is that it provides for us a very graphic picture of the captivity that we're in our sin. Look at the descriptions, if you would, of the demon-possessed man and see if you don't identify in the descriptions of him the reality of what it is that sin does to us. Here's a man that's living among the tombs in verse 3. I mean, are we not dead in our sin, even while we live? And here is a man who's alive, but dead for all practical purposes. Here is a man who is alive, but who lives not with the living. Here's a man that lives with those that are dead. Here's a man that hurts people. He's a menace to society. And so they have tried to lock him up with shackles and chains, we read in verse 4. And doesn't sin hurt other people? I mean, when we lie, doesn't it hurt somebody? When we are not faithful, does that unfaithfulness not damage someone else? And so our sin has an effect on our family, on our loved ones, on our coworkers, on our community, on the people around us. You never sin, no matter how private it might seem to be, that it doesn't have some kind of impact on the people around you. Here's a man who's out of control, and does sin not do that? I mean, does it not cause you to just, it escalates. It doesn't stay in one place. It doesn't stay static. It's dynamic. And so here is a man who's spinning out of control. He tore apart the chains. He broke apart the shackles. He got to the point that nobody could even bind him anymore, we're told in verse 3. So they just gave up. And can't you imagine when people like traveled to the shore there where they herded the swine or passed by that cemetery, that they could hear the man in his chains or hear him howling at night? And here was a very graphic picture of how it is that when a man is controlled by Satan, how his life is just out of control. He's alone and ostracized, no family, no friends. He lives alone in the tombs or in the mountains, we're told, also in verse 5, as he wanders around. Nobody wants to have anything to do with him. And doesn't sin do that? I mean, doesn't it, because it hurts other people, doesn't it break relationships? Doesn't it isolate people? Don't people find themselves alone in their sin? He's restless and unhappy, we read in verse 5. Constantly, night and day, he is crying out. Here is a man who is living in misery, and doesn't sin do that? Oh, it promises. Satan promised us happiness. He promised us it would be better. He painted the picture of something that was beautiful, of freedom, of being free of boundaries. But what we find is that it didn't do any of that at all. In fact, what it brings us is misery. And here is a man who's restless and miserable. He's self-destructive. And isn't that the truth of sin? He is gouging or gashing himself with stones, not only hurting other people, but hurting himself. And here is a man who is, and this is especially what is portrayed, and what needs to be portrayed in the picture of the demon-possessed man as a metaphor for sin. Here is a man who's a prisoner or a slave or a puppet of Satan. He's not in control at all anymore. He has completely relinquished control of his life to Satan, who is pulling the strings, who's calling the shots. And in order to show just how powerful that captivity is, there is this interrogation that happens when Jesus asks his name. And what we learn is that there's not one demon, there's a whole legion of demons that have possessed this man. And we see the power of them when they are permitted to go into the swine, just how powerful that captivity is. We got to see that picture, folks. We have to see what it is that sin does to us. We have to see just how, and this is the final point to see, how helpless we are in that condition. No one can do anything for this man. Nobody can help him. He can't help himself. Nobody wants to help him except Jesus. And guess who shows up on his shore? The Son of God to come and help him. I tell you that I've seen and see stuff like this every day. I've not only seen this man, I've been this man. Maybe you have too when you look at your sin. This story not only unmasks the ugliness of sin, it also unmasks the truth that sin has many faces. It unmasks the truth that sin has many faces. Are you struck by the reaction of the townspeople when they turn out to this scene? So the demons go into the swine, 2,000 of them, and they run down the bank and into the sea, and they all drown there. And the herdsmen, they are the witnesses to this event, and so they run into the town, they run into the country, and they begin telling everybody about this remarkable scene. And so all the townspeople come out to the shore, and we're told in verse 15 what they see when they arrive. They observe Jesus, and they see this man, the man that had the legion, the man that wore the chains and the shackles, the man that nobody could bind, the man that was gashing himself with stones, the man that was naked and unclothed because of his behavior, the man that nobody could control, and here he is sitting down, clothed, and in his right mind. And then they look into the sea, and they see all the corpses there, all the pigs, that are the carcasses floating in the sea. And then the herdsmen begin to relate like everything that happened, what happened with the demon-possessed man, and what happened with the pigs. Are you struck by the fact that nobody rejoices? Nobody runs over and hugs the man and says, "We're so glad you're back. Praise God that he's delivered you." And quite the opposite. The people are afraid when they witness what has occurred there, and they ask Jesus, "Would you please leave?" They don't want him there. I say to you again that one of the things this story does for us that we see every day is that it unmasks the truth that sin has many faces. We need to see the picture, the ugly picture of sin, when it takes a person and their life is out of control. And when the damage, where the bondage is so apparent in the loss, but sin doesn't always it's not always so apparent on the surface of how ugly it is. But one of the things that happens in this story is the Lord tears the scabs off. I mean, he shows us what's going on, not just in the man. He shows us what's going on in the town. Here are people who are materialistic. They see the man and they see the pigs. They see the man, but they can't take their eyes off the pigs. There is a value on this property that has been lost in the sea, and more value on what has been lost in the sea than on what has been gained in this man whom the Lord has redeemed. Here's a people without mercy or sympathy. There is no celebration. There is no praise God. There is no wonder in them. There is no amazement over how great God is. No celebration, no praises. Nobody sings a song, "How I love the great Redeemer here." That doesn't happen. There is no godly fear or awe on the part of the people. Oh, there's fear. We're told very plainly in verse 5 that they are frightened by what happens. But it's not a godly fear that draws them closer to God. I think by way of contrast, when Moses came to the burning bush where he was in the presence of God, and he was certainly frightened, but he came near. And here's a people that witness something that is an awesome spectacle or sight, but instead of wanting to come nearer, they want to get away from it. Here's a people that are spiritually oblivious, shallow, not thinking about how momentous an event they've witnessed and how this has to be the finger of God. And not thinking about if Jesus could do this for this man, if he would do this for this man, if God would do this for one man, then would he not be good for us? Would he not help us? If he can deliver him from the bondage that he's in, are there not things in my life that he could help me change? But they're so shallow, they're so superficial, they don't think beyond the surface of their own loss here. The fact is that the citizens of the town are just as much prisoners as the demon-possessed man, are they not? They are captives too. And they don't even know it. And so this beautiful story unmasked for us the truth that sin has many faces. But I do want us to think a little more carefully about the impact of this miracle on the townspeople. The fact is that what Jesus did for this man did cost them something. And what was for them an unpleasant price. 2,000 pigs. That's a lot of bacon, isn't it? That's a lot of hams. And those pigs belong to somebody. And probably more than one somebody. So I don't know how many of the townspeople had a stake in this herd that was there. But, it's all washed up, isn't it? I mean, it's all gone. It's all disappeared now. The price of pork just went up in the Gerasenes. And here are herdsmen that are all out of job. And 2,000 pigs floating in the sea, I mean, that's got to be some kind of health crisis, does it not? I mean, something had to be done to clean up that mess. I don't know what they were equipped to do in that time. I don't know if they had the capacity. I haven't researched that, whether they could cure the meat or not. Or whether they would even want to when there has been this kind of, if they died in this kind of way, if the people would even want to do that. And so either they're going to have to cure the meat and slaughter all these hogs, or they're going to have to burn the bodies or bury the bodies. They're going to have to do something, and somebody has got to do all that work. Question. Who is to blame for this crisis? Whose fault was it that they lost their property and men lost their jobs and now they've got this little health predicament there? Was it Jesus' fault or was it Satan's fault? Look, if you would, at verse 13 of the text where it says that coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them. and they were drowned in the sea. It would look, would appear as if that the demons were responsible for driving the swine down the hill and into the sea, that that was intentional on their part, that they were the ones that were responsible for this disaster. But if you look back at verse 12, it says the demons entreated Jesus, saying, "Send us into the swine so that we may enter them." And he gave them permission. And so they weren't allowed, they didn't just do this on their own. Jesus gave them permission to go into the swine, and he granted it. Did Jesus not know what they were going to do? I mean, did he not know what was up here? And so who was responsible for this loss? Was Jesus responsible, or was Satan responsible? Or rather, did both have a hand in this event? My conclusion is that it was the latter. That Satan had a hand in what happened here, and that the Lord had a hand in what happened here. And the further thing that I think we get help in seeing in this text is that this is the sort of thing that happens all the time. I mean, there are things that go on in our world all the time that that are inexplicable to us because we can't see what's going on behind the scenes. I mean, we are not privy any more than Job was to the conversation that happened when the sons of God appear before the throne of God, and where there's this conversation between God and Satan. "Behold my servant Job." And Satan says, "Well, you know, the only reason he's that way, the only reason why he believes in you is because you built a hedge around him." And then God gives Satan some permission to take something away from Job. But here we have in this story, just like we have in that story, we have a picture of the fact that there are things that are going on behind the scenes of what's going on in our world. When something happens to our economy, who's responsible for that? When something happens in our workplace or in our job or in the particular market that we work in, who's responsible for that? When there's some kind of natural disaster that happens in our world, is that God or is that Satan? Or when there's some kind of sickness or some kind of malady or something that is suffered on a macro scale or on the micro scale of my own person or of my own family, who is behind that? I can't untangle all of that. I don't know the particulars of just what went on, when, and what was said, and how that. But what I do know is that there is a part that God is having in that, and there is a part that Satan is having in that. And what is unmasked for us in this story is that there is, that both God and Satan are active in our world. I mean, very active in our world. Active every day, all the time in our world. And what they are doing is competing for the hearts of men. That's what's going on. And whatever else, now that's not going to be said on the news. That's not what CNN or what Fox or what anybody is going to be talking about tomorrow morning or 24/7 anymore, right? That's not what you're going to find on the Yahoo news page. I mean, but this is the reality about what's really going on in the world, what really goes on every day, all the time, right now, right here in the pew, is that God is actively seeking you, pursuing your heart, your devotion to Him. And Satan is doing what he can too to try to win your allegiance to Him. That's what's really going on in our world. And this story unmasks that for us. So that maybe we step back and we look at our life and we look at our circumstance and what's happening right now. And know that in the good and in the bad, God's hand is in it all. And Satan, he's involved in what's going on too. Now, it's not so hard, is it, to see the strategy of Satan here? It's not hard to figure out the simplicity of what he's attempting to do. He doesn't mind, does he, giving up the demon-possessed man if he can turn the whole town against Jesus? And so that looks like a pretty good, like, strategy. Okay? You can have the demon-possessed man. I mean, nobody likes him anyway. He's already burned all his bridges. Who wants him home? I mean, who cares Who cares, Jesus? You can have that guy. I mean, he's crazy. Everybody knows he's crazy. So yeah, you can have him and let me take the respectable people of this town who chase you out and don't want you to come near. I'll take them. You can have him. Looks like a good bargain for Satan. So what's Jesus' strategy here? Well, the fact is, Jesus didn't have the town to begin with, did he? I mean, it's not like the people like overnight became materialistic. It's not like they all of a sudden became people that didn't have sympathy or mercy. It's not like they all of a sudden became spiritually oblivious because of the loss of their pigs. I mean, they didn't just get there because of this event. What this event did was expose that they were already there. All it did was peel off show what was under the surface so that we can see in this story the rawness, the ugliness, just how festering even polite sin, acceptable sin can be in our world. And so the loss only exposed the way that they already were. So what's Jesus' strategy here? Well, I tell you what I love about what Jesus did. They did suffer loss. I don't know what 2,000 pigs are worth in that day, but I expect it was a pretty penny. And so Jesus took the cost of 2,000 pigs, and what he did was hire them a preacher. The people asked him to leave, and Jesus agreed to do so, so he was getting into the boat. And as he was getting into the boat in verse 18, it says that the man who had been demon-possessed was entreating him that he might accompany him. And guess what Jesus said? Nope. That doesn't seem fair, does it? But Jesus says, no, you're going to stay here. You're going to stay here. And you're going to go home to your people, and you're going to report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and is how he has had mercy on you. And so Jesus took their pigs, but he gave them a preacher. And what a hard job this new preacher had. Can you imagine being given the task of being a messenger to a people that when you were saved, when God rescued you, nobody celebrated. Nobody was happy. But that's his audience. That's his congregation. The congregation is the hometown that did not rejoice, that wanted their pigs back and didn't want him, but God left them him. But I tell you, here's another beautiful picture of the wisdom of God, of the strategy of Jesus in this. What does this man as a new disciple need? He needs what all of us need as new disciples. He needs to learn the habit of showing others the grace, the truth, the love that God has shown him. Isn't that right? I mean, isn't that what God wants to do in us? Is he wants our character. That's what discipleship is. He wants us to be shaped like he is. He wants his heart to be in our heart. He wants us to love people the way that he's loved us. And that's the way that we know that we've become transformed by the gospel, is it changes the way that we behave, not just in worship and in gratitude toward God, but it also means that we embrace God's purpose and we join with him in that. We want to multiply the family. We want to share with others and show to others what has been shown toward us. And so part of how he engages us in this battle that is raging between him and Satan is he employs us in the battle. He gives us a mission. He gives us a purpose. And part of overcoming sin is that we fight against it by rescuing others, by showing them the same kind of heart that God has shown us. And so Jesus has given this man what he needs most. He's given him the opportunity to learn the habit of showing others the grace and truth and love that God has shown him. He didn't deserve it. They don't deserve it. They deserve each other, don't they? And so Jesus gives him a chance to be a real disciple. And what this people need is a messenger who's not afraid to tell them what they need to hear. And oh my, is he going to do that, isn't he? I just picture Jesus has left, and I don't know if they had a place in town like the Standpipe. Is that what it's called, the coffee house? But maybe this man is, at the table there. And somebody comes in and recognizes him, and something has finally clicked for them. And they come down and say, can I join you at the table here? And they begin to relate, things that are broken in their home or things that are broken in their life, things that ain't right. And then he begins to tell the story about how he was a prisoner, about how he was alone, about how he hurt people the way this guy's hurting people, or was hurt the way this man was hurt. He talks about how he was lost and alone and self-destructive, how he was a prisoner of Satan. And Jesus came all the way across the sea to spend just a few hours in the land of the Gerasenes just to save him. It's the only thing Jesus did when he was there, just this one man. And we see in this beautiful story how far God will go to save one sinner. And so he tells the guy that's sitting across the table from him, my Jesus, who's redeemed me, he can help you too. That's what's going on in our world. And you could read this story every day, and it's the real story. It's the real story. And I don't know the dynamics of your family. I don't know the particulars of your life. I don't know what's going on in your world. But I can tell you this. This is what's going on in your world. It is universally true. There is an ugliness in our world, and that ugliness is sin. And this is what it looks like. And that sin has more than one face. This is also what that looks like. And there is this battle that's going on. There is this contest. There is this great contest. And it is the only one that matters. This is the only contest that matters. It's this war that's being waged for the hearts of men by God and Satan. And both of them are active in our world. And that's going on in your life right now. Satan has a strategy, but God has a better one. And he will go to any length to pursue you and to win you and to change you and to redeem you and to rescue you. And there is nobody else that can do that but Jesus. And he wants to. He wants to so bad that he will go to the same trouble in your life as he went to in this man's life, to set you free and to make you one of his people. Don't you love that? Won't you come to this Jesus tonight? Won't you have him set you free from your chains? Won't you have him give you a family that will love you and embrace you and accept you the same way that he does? Won't you join alongside the rest of us sinners who've been redeemed in like fashion, whom God has set free from our chains, whom God has come and found us in our need and has made us whole, has healed us? Won't you be healed too? Won't you come and confess your faith in Jesus Christ? Won't you repent of your sins? Won't you be washed in the blood, be buried with him in baptism, and raised to walk a new life? Won't you come march with us to Zion, where he's waiting for us, with a home for us there? Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?